Blog Talk Radio.
Country large as ours be scared of such a threat? Well, if they won't work for us, they're against us, you can bet. They may be sovereign countries, but you folks at home forget that they all want what we've got, but they don't know it yet.
Tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la.
Guns and our corporate muscle marches in behind us. But freedom's just another word for nothing left to sell. And if you want narcotics, we can get you those as well. We help the multinationals when they cry out, protect us. The locals scream and shout a bit, but we don't let that affect us. We're here to lend a helping hand in case they don't elect us. How dare they buy our products and still they don't respect us?
Tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la.
Privately owned radios to be immediately impounded.
Yeah, man.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Well, there is such a place, Trouble. There must be. Not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon. Beyond the rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an announcement.
I can no longer sit back and allow the conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Let's talk about
creeping like a communist. It's knocking at our doors, voraciously devouring the way things are today. Savagely deflowering the
official story.
Yeah!
Free Kansas.
Madness.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Why should you put your hands, G.I.?
Now, why don't you just take it easy? Please make me a drink of grain alcohol and rainwater and help yourself to whatever you'd like.
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Kansas.
Ear to the ground, voice in the air worldwide.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed.
Radio Free Kansas.
I've washed away all my sins and transgressions.
You can listen in.
Be they congressmen or preachers, the only ones who made the feature were those who knew their station. Is that a man or a corporation? Each spineless fan who won that round went on to the big buck battleground. They bought some ads, they bought some more, they got freebies by the score. Hired thugs went door to door, especially if you're black or poor. Said your vote might be against the law. Don't tell me the deal is raw. We had an election, it ain't no lie. It was the best one money could buy. Every word uttered by these two old birds, as if their tongues were heaven sent. They didn't tell us what was meant, no voting record to analyze, and watch as they feign surprise when history proves to us again the thieving crooks who are these men. We had an election, it ain't no lie, it was the best one money could buy. From those dirty commie peacenik nerds, there will be debates, slogans will fly, but only rich men need apply. There's only room up there for two, Tweedledee and Tweedledoo. Uncounted ballots will litter the floor, this banana Republican class war. We had an election, it ain't no lie, it was the best one money could buy. The pundits will say democracy won. Some will cry into their socks. Some will sit and watch more Fox, where scandals, wars, and desperation are all the fault of the United Nations, while those who drill the oil, make the tanks, laugh out loud all the way to the banks. We had an election, it ain't no lie, it was the best one money could buy.
Well, here we are. We're ready. We're going to be having, welcome to Radio Free Kansas. We're going to have Dr. Michael Parente on at the bottom of this hour, and we'll take up his time a little bit and keep him busy, hopefully. Maybe we can get his gray cells moving a little bit in his head. Did anyone check out last night's Wichita Peace Center special with Tom Hayden? It was tough. It was tough, brothers and sisters, getting that out there to with any audio quality. I'm real sorry. The first half hour was shot, but we got him on. We got Tom Hayden on, and I'll be comparing some of the things that Hayden was talking about with Dr. Parente once we have him on. You know, there's a lot. Noam Chomsky, Professor Noam Chomsky, 84 years. Old. His birthday was yesterday on Pearl Harbor Day. That's probably one of the reasons he doesn't make a big deal. I don't know. His birthday was 84, birthday, December 7th. And also today, for many of you. It reminded me of a woman that, around Occupy Wichita, reminded me that that's true through Facebook. She 32 years ago, John Lennon was killed outside his apartment at the Dakota building. And, of course, this week, Dave Brubeck, I'm not sure what his politics were, but he sure played some pretty sounding music. And we'll stay in that vein. Per the request of Dr. Parente, he'd like something melodious and soothing. Here's Dave Brubeck, gone this week, 91 years of age. Leading progressive political analysts. They are entertaining books, I'll tell you that for sure. Michael Parenti, PARENTI.org. MichaelParenti.org. You won't regret it. Check it out. His archives are there. that, I believe, 1966 at Oberlin College. I'm not sure about that. It's the extended version. I hope you enjoyed it. Gone at 91. He lived a ripe age. Now we'll put on a, real quickly a dedication to Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, the Great Plains chapter. That's right, we have one here in Kansas. Speech delivered by President of the name, Americans United, in the Great Plains chapter, Vicki Stangle. Homage to the sister for standing up to Reverend Dr. Governor Brownback, Sam Brownback of Kansas. Today, right now, as we're speaking, a huge religious revival being conducted across the street from our governor's mansion, Cedar Crest, in Topeka, Kansas. A very large simulcast televised religious revival demanding repentance from all of us, conducted and promoted by Dr. Reverend Governor Sam Brownback. Here's Vicki Stangle speaking on the steps of the Topeka State House, our Capitol building, last spring. Then we'll hook up with Dr. Prenti.
Women's politics at Wichita State University. She also believes in this thing called separation of church and state.
Yeah.
She believes so strongly in it that she headed the Midwest chapter of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. She spoke out here against these private school masters that they tried to pass this year. That's her right field. All right, I am your last speaker, so I'll try to make this as quick as possible. I'd like you to take a good look. The building behind me is not a church. This building is a public edifice dedicated to the business of governing the state. Now, there was a time when European monarchs and popes conspired together as one to govern the people. This marriage of church and state created unstable, disjointed, and violent governments that abused the rights of citizens they were charged to protect. Our founders did not wish to build another government grounded in religious tyranny and absolutism. They labored to create a government where secular laws would be free from the dictates of sectarian doctrine, where all citizens could personally embrace their own beliefs. James Madison, the father of the United States Constitution, worried about the dangers of religious factions and what would happen if the strains of religious extremism were allowed to take hold in the American government. For too long, religious extremists in Kansas government have dominated the political landscape and made a mockery of our free, secular republic. That's right. These politicians want to turn the state house into a cathedral for their brand of faith. They believe their God, their religious traditions, their beliefs should dictate public policy for all Kansans. In their arrogance, they have concocted laws based upon misogynist doctrines without any concerns for the rights and freedoms of Kansas women. Today, no government business can be conducted in Kansas without first bowing to the religious extremists. At all levels of government, their narrow view infects public policy. At the state level, an attempt was made to give taxpayer money through backdoor school vouchers to religious schools and thereby weaken public schools. Passage of the Kansas Preservation of Religious Freedom Act would allow individuals to discriminate against gays and lesbians based upon the employer's religious beliefs. As a ridiculous bill that would define life as beginning at fertilization is clearly the most shocking assault on women's civil liberties and autonomy as full persons. Yes, yes, the war on women will not succeed without setting up a theocratic state. To accomplish this, elected officials in Kansas refuse to respect the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution, which prohibits the government from favoring one religion or faith to rule government. Kansas officials also disregard with impunity Article 7 under the Kansas Bill of Rights. It reads in part that in Kansas, no preference may be given under law to any religious establishment or mode of worship. Defining life as beginning at fertilization certainly establishes under the law one religious doctrine of faith for all to obey. Kansas women have no intention of allowing religious doctrines to corrupt our laws. We most certainly reject any Christian doctrine supported by legislative statutes to degrade women's civil liberties and freedoms. To be clear, women are not chattel, they are not baby machines, they are not sex slaves to their male masters. Women are human beings who have every right to do what is right for their health and mental freedom. All Kansas must stand up against the horrific political malpractice taking place in Kansas against women.
Shut up.
We must not be bullied by politicians who despise any woman for refusing to balance submissiveness to the state that seeks to control her womb. Upholding the separation of church and state is the only way we can stop the theocratic madness in Kansas. Today, we stand together to loudly proclaim we will not be defeated by the religious extremists in Kansas government. The forces behind the suppression of women and their rights are powerful, but we must be more powerful, more dedicated to preserving the separation of church and state if we are to live free and determine our own destiny as citizens of this democratic republic. Victory is our only option.
Well, we have Dr. Michael Parenti online. Again, listeners, I can't encourage you enough to go to Michael Parenti, EARENTI.org. That's the best way to get a hold of him. And more importantly, check out the huge number of books he's put out. His latest, Face of Imperialism, is great stuff. I mean, this guy, if you haven't listened to his lectures, and I know I've played a bunch of them from Moriah. I was just straightened out by Dr. Parenti. Moriah Gallardin's TUC Radio. I have played a lot of his lectures for you regular listeners. You know well I've done that. Anyhow, I want to bring Dr. Parenti on because we don't have a lot of time with him. I want to use it to the best. And here's Dr. Michael Parenti.
Hey, how are you?
If I can get him on. Are you okay, Dr. Parenti? Is it okay to talk now?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty much settled in, but I just need to get my throat cleared here. Okay, here we go.
Yeah, well, Dr. Parenti, I appreciate you spending some time with us in Radio Free Kansas. I assure you there are hundreds of Kansans who listen to our show via podcast, and it is a very important time because you're the first real, well, I don't know if you like being called this, but you're sort of the first real radical philosopher and political scientist to come on Radio Free Kansas. We've had Chalmers Johnson on, when he was alive, and it's just an honor to have you here because I think dialectical materialism is still applicable today, and I hope you can help us out a little bit in understanding what many of the people call the objective situation where we face today. And thank you for coming on.
Well, it's my pleasure.
You know,
what would you like to talk about?
Well, first, right off the top of my head, Tom Hayden, everybody knows Tom Hayden. He was in Wichita at the Wichita Peace Center, and I know you are described as a non-sectarian. This isn't meaning in any sectarian way. But Tom Hayden, we broadcast him speaking at the Wichita Peace Center last night. And it was the 20th anniversary of the Peace Center down there. And that was the first time I'd ever heard Tom Hayden in Kansas. But one thing he said that was really, he said a lot of things, but one thing he said that was really sticking in my craw was he was talking about us being in the path. He's talking about Kansans, people in the Midwest, the progressives in the Midwest, what few of us are left. Standing in the path of counter, this is a quote, standing in the path of counter-revolution to the Kochs, the Koch billionaire brothers who are headquartered in Wichita, Kansas. And, I was wondering what you think progressives would do here in the Midwest other than go to the East or the West Coast. We want to stand and fight, Dr. Parenti. We need your help.
Yeah, well, what the reactionaries have done is they've recognized that ideas do have an effect, that ideas do influence the way people think, and the way people think will then influence the way they behave and who they support. And they have, for these last 30, 40 years, been doing a long march through the institutions, through the media, through the various state governments and everything. Well, the Democrats have just been sitting there twiddling and are just thinking about this issue or trying to get that bill through or something. While that's happening, you've got people like the Koch brothers and other multimillionaires financing all sorts of think tanks and new journals and magazines and buying up radio stations and controlling the media. We have our dearest enemy, Rupert Murdoch, who's been buying up every major newspaper he's bought up all the newspapers in Australia. He's buying up newspapers in England. He bought the London Times. He's bought in the U.S. He's bought the Wall Street Journal, and he's talking to buy a few others. And he's got Fox Network News, which operates like a propaganda machine. These Koch brothers have picked it up from Murdoch and others like them who wage a propaganda war and who convince the ordinary working people of places like Kansas and Oklahoma and places like that, who at one time were populists, who at one time would vote for the guy who supported the little man and such, and today they give their vote to the Republican Party, the party of corporate America. Although both parties serve corporate America, but the Republicans have become an even more extreme organization. It's like a Leninist operation, although with different politics than Lenin. But, the rigor and the control, you know.
They do run it sort of as a totalitarian party here in Kansas. The Kansas Republican Party has the current Secretary of State, Chris Kobach, even when he was president or chairman of the Kansas Republican Party, he demanded loyalty oaths from members that were elected members holding office in the Kansas Republican Party in the state legislature. And it went over sort of like passing gas in a submarine. But I'll tell you right now, progressives here in Kansas, we want to fight. We feel like that this is an important moment in our personal, in our political and personal history. And the Kansas Democratic Party, you just said it. You hit the nail on the head. We fight like hell to get just one or two laws passed, and it's still, it's not bringing people. It's very tough. It's very tough, and I'm really interested in.
Right, and
I want to throw one thing at you today. At this moment, today, December 8th was the date that Bill Clinton, I think in 92 or 93, somewhere in the early 90s when he was president. Today is the day he signed NAFTA. I did not know that until I was looking at the calendar. And there's a great Democrat, I think. You know, I don't know. What do you think about?
Well, then.
Go ahead.
Well, I started to say they're waging a war of propaganda. They have explanations for everything, and the Democrats don't. Although, on NAFTA, to tell your listeners, is the North American Free Trade Agreement, and what that did was abolish all the regulations and protections that farmers and workers and producers had in various countries against larger intrusions coming in. Now there's my neighbor's dog. I hope you don't hear it. But
we go.
And what these free trade agreements do is they elevate the property right over every other right. They steal away our democratic ability to vote for a public insurance company, because that would restrain trade, or public this, or we want farm protections on our prices. We don't want some other company. We don't want some rich agribusiness thing dumping their products into our market. Say in Mexico, we've wiped out the NAFTA, wiped out the Mexican farmers who were small, very small farmers, very productive though. About 2/3 of America's winter vegetables came from Mexico and such. Now all of that's been wiped out. Big corn and big heavily subsidized by American money go right in, and under free trade, there's no more protections, and they take over. But the thing about the Koch brothers and Murdoch and Fox and all this is they give an explanation. They give talking points to their people. So people will get up there and they will be reciting the little slogans that they've heard on the air. I heard one guy say, "I believe marriage is between Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve." Now that's a line he got from the people who are organizing against gay marriage, you know. And they've got their arguments all lined up and ready. And with the Democrats and with the progressives, generally what you get is just somebody saying they have a right too, and that's that, you know. Instead of building a polemic on it and pointing out that in Europe there's been gay marriage, and the and the societies haven't fallen apart. Canada has had gay marriage for what, 7-8 years now, and marriage for heterosexuals is as safe and secure as it ever was. Nobody's bothering any man and woman or trying to keep them from getting married. Marriage is not being undermined. If anything, it's being strengthened and expanded as an institution. So what is so missing from the liberal wing of this political spectrum in this country is any kind of real ideological development and explanations and linking different things, showing people how the power of money is really affecting their lives, affecting their livelihoods, affecting their mortgage payments, affecting everything. And that's what's been sadly neglected since Ronald Reagan days. We've had the Republic, we had the GOP and the reactionaries just lying to us back and forth, but building up a set of explanations that people just by the process of repeating and repeating and repeating it, it becomes plausible and it becomes true. And this is also true for empire. They don't tell us what the empire is. The empire is the U.S. building about 800 bases all around the world, intruding in all different countries to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. That's what it's for, to stop any country, whether it's democratic or autocratic or has run by a dictator or run with a parliament. Any country that tries to use the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets of its own country for its own development, any country that commits economic nationalism for itself, that country will be targeted as a threat, unfriendly to the U.S. Noriega, you know, they demonize the leader. Noriega of Panama was a Hitler admirer, which he was not at all. Gaddafi was a monster dictator.
Hello?
Which he was not at all. Hello? What
Hello?
Happened? Hello? Hello?
You still there, Hello? Dr. Prentice?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been talking at some length.
Yeah. Not... Yeah. No. It's okay. We heard up to just a few seconds ago. Well, you know, Noriega, we had, I don't know, I guess they caught him with a bunch of coke and money, according to federal agents. That was the last straw, according to federal agents.
Oh, that's
agents.
Baloney, Mike. That's every single leader, every single U.S.-supported leader in Latin America, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, every single one of them, the generals and the political leaders were all in on the drug stuff, all in on the cocaine stuff, but as long as they played along with corporate America, they were fine. Nobody raised a single question. Noriega probably was the least. No, Noriega's real sin was that he wouldn't back the U.S. in their war against revolutionary Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Once he started that, wow, they went after him, and they murdered his boss. Torrijos was killed in that airplane crash. He kept talking about how they're going to get him that way, or he had nightmares about it and such. They'll always make up some. With Saddam Hussein, they loved Saddam Hussein in Iraq. That Saddam Hussein was brought forth by the CIA. He ended up wiping out every constitutionalist, every Democrat, every reformer, every socialist. He wiped them out in Iraq. He even wiped out the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist party. And when he did that, he was Washington's poster boy. They loved him. They had him up there, and that was fine. The minute he got out of line on the oil quotas, where he wanted a larger quota, that is, a larger share of the oil market where he could sell Iraq's oil, which was a very high-quality oil, the minute he refused to privatize the oil companies again after the Iraq Revolution, he kept the whole economy as a public state-run economy. That's when they started condemning him and calling him a monster, and he's got weapons of mass destruction, and he's another Hitler, and he might try to destroy all of Europe or America. That's when they started all those stories. So this is what they do. They demonize the leader of a particular country. Yesterday was Gaddafi. The day before it was Saddam Hussein. Today it's Assad. Tomorrow it'll be Ahmadinejad in Iran, if they start bombing Iran. They demonize the leader. They tell the American people that this guy isn't our friend, that he's out to get us, and they stir up fear among American public. And when you frighten people enough, they're ready to hand over their rights to you and surrender their liberty to make sure that a strong state will protect them and their families and their communities. And so once you convince them that the guy is a demon, this gives you license then to go and bomb his country, and or send mercenaries in, or send Al-Qaeda killers in, who you supposedly said were our enemies and they're terrorists and they would come to get us. And then you're using them in places like Libya and in Syria. So they get these mercenary killers in there and they overthrow the government. Now you can bring the IMF in. Now you can bring in the big oil companies, come back and they can take it all again. And all the while telling the American people, well, we're fighting terrorism. We're fighting the guys who, I mean, look what they did with Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with 9/11. I mean, I heard him interviewed. He was tickled and delighted about it. He said, well, we're fighting back. We're keeping you people off us and all that. I mean, it's not a guy you particularly want to hug, you know. But he wasn't the one... He would have claimed credit for it. He said it was a group of young men in the West. They did it. It was amazing what they did. Blah blah blah. So we build up these demons who are going to get us, and you keep the American people in constant fear. I lived through that all my life when I was a kid. It was the communists everywhere. The communists are so ruthless. They are ruthless. They are power hungry. That's what they want, is power and power. And look, they surrendered. 100,000 people marched in Moscow, and they gave up the whole system, and they moved toward a capitalist system. But this was it. And now the communism is gone. It's the terrorists. We got the terrorists here, terrorists there, going to get your mama, you know. And so it is. Keep the people frightened, and in that way you can justify using $100 billion. Or almost $1 trillion of their money every year in a stimulus package. You know, you talk about a stimulus package. Well, we got a big one. It's called the defense budget. And you spend that money every year, and you keep building up more and more of this stuff. I disagree with your late friend Chalmers Johnson that it was just power for power's sake. It was overweening, arrogance, and that it was the power was used for political economic reasons, to make sure you had friendly countries out there that did what we said, and made sure countries that opened up their land, their labor, their markets, their capital to the IMF and to big private corporations who could come in and take over, and that's what it's for. It's for that class, that 1% that wants to control all the wealth, all there is to control. And that's what free trade is all about and the like.
Well, people say that, I talk to you here, never mind their political philosophy. Here's a cute phrase. Imperialism is an old word. And your book is named The Face of Imperialism, your latest book of many. And they say that's an old word. It's antiquated. It doesn't really exist. We don't take over colonies and stuff like that. But what you're saying is sort of the other side of it. You're saying that in the case of Noriega, all the generals were drug-dealing gangsters, so to say, and Noriega just got out of line. And one more thing for you to...
Let me answer that first thing about imperialism is an old word. They're equating imperialism with colonialism, but there's imperialism and there's neo-imperialism or neo-colonialism. The first form is when the British take over India, they bring their army in, they bring their own viceroys in, and they form a whole direct possession. They own they owned India and all that. Well, under neo-imperialism, and the U.S. was one of the earliest practitioners of neo-imperialism, and that came with Hawaii, with Cuba, for instance. We took Cuba from the Spaniards. We owned Cuba for a while there, for a couple of years, but we gave them their independence. And the independence is you give them their own flag, their own constitution, their own currency, and you put a leader in like Batista who does what we want. And so the country is ostensibly free and independent now, but the U.S. interests own the cotton, the oil. Let's see, in Cuba it would be the tobacco and the sugar and the nickel refineries and the tourist trade and all that. And they made lots of money out of Cuba. The Cubans were poor, but the rich owners there, the casino owners and everything, and the plantation owners and such, they were rich. So that's the imperialism. The Cubans had the husk of independence, while the big corporate American investor interests had the heart of it, the meat of it.
Well, would you say, I'll be right, I'm on speakerphone, I had to come out, I'll be right back, but, you know, would you say that this new neo-imperialism is a form that's, like expressed, like you alluded to earlier in the IMF?
There wasn't
an IMF, I don't think there was an IMF when the British Empire was around.
No, yeah, that's it. There are new mechanisms of international financial control of a country, and the IMF is one of the instruments. It comes into the country, it takes over the banking system, it takes over the investments, and it pretty much runs things. It gets the country to cut back cut back on its social services and cut back on its wages and the like, and make the country a cash cow that the IMF can milk for the big banking interests of the world. Just like it does, that's the way it does the same thing here at home. You know, we talk about why would we go and do all that? Why would we? I said, well, first of all, it's not we, okay? Stop using we.
Right.
It's they. It's these guys on Wall Street and the like and corporate America who, why would they do it over there and cut back on people's social services and their wages and their home ownership and all that? They do it here. They do it right here in your own country. You want to see what imperialism looks like? Just look like what's been happening in America over the last 20, 30 years, and you'll get a sense. Wages are flat. Profits are going up higher and higher. The very rich, that 1%, has more and more of the wealth than the 99%. And our social programs are under constant attack.
Here in Kansas, amen. They are here.
Yeah, they rolled back.
Governor Brownback. That's what he's doing. He's just and his cohorts in Michigan and Wisconsin and the so-called red states. They're butchering the social services and the public education systems. You know.
Public education, libraries closing down, public hospitals shutting, or the hours cut back, all sorts of things, disability insurance and caregiving stuff cut back, and that you know, the word is hardship. It's not hardship. It's really close to the end for people. If they, some people I know disabled people, if they live in fear, they were just living in fear that their services were going to be cut back. They were so afraid. A very close friend of mine, she was so afraid that Romney would win, and he didn't win. But then she's got to fear Obama, because this guy is putting Social Security and Medicare on the table. He says it. He even said, I'm not wedded. He's already making on the taxes. He's already making concessions before they've even got sat down at the table to start negotiating the thing. He already makes concessions, and he talks about compromises. He wins a goddamn election. Oh, excuse my English. He wins an election. Overwhelmingly wins the election, and the first thing he starts talking about is all the concessions he's going to make to the Republicans. That's all he can do. That's all he ever does. And compromise, and how he could compromise. Well, why should we compromise on our Social Security? Social Security is self-financing. It's not even in the budget. We talk about a budget that has all these deficits and all that. Well, Social Security runs a $40 billion surplus every year. And there's about $2.5 trillion surplus in the Social Security fund. And that money has been used, and they just print up Treasury notes, which are like IOUs, that are owed to Social Security, you see. And meanwhile, they keep talking about how, oh, it's going to run out. Oh, it isn't being financed. It's being perfectly well financed. And in fact, if it ever does get to the point where it starts going low, you can just simply raise the cap on the higher income people who pay Social Security. And again, that's not taking anything away from them. It's just making them pay a bit more into the fund. They'll still be getting a good payment when they retire.
Yeah, I don't see why the millionaires and billionaires aren't paying Social Security funds as it is now. You know, you had a great phrase. I was listening to your most recent lecture and that I could get my hands on, and it's the empire is feeding off the republic. Isn't that your quote?
That's correct. Yes, that's mine. And, well, that's the point I just made.
Tell us about it. Is that what you're referring to when you refer to Obama and these cannibalizing off of the social services, Governor Brownback and on up?
Well, they just simply want less for the many and more for the few. That's Brownback. I mean, his service is a reactionary agenda. His idea is people just have to fend for themselves and all that. Well, why doesn't he apply it to his corporate friends? There's nobody who's more on the public dole than big corporations. The handouts in terms of subsidies and export subsidies and equity and all sorts of other kinds of things. The money that corporate America gets, it comes to about $280 billion a year. They get more handouts. You don't get any handouts. I don't get. If your income goes down or your little business goes down or whatever it is, and falls, that's too bad. You're out. That's all. But the big banks are too big to fail, and the big companies are too big to fail, and so the truth is that he doesn't support smaller government. He supports big government for the big guys and small government for the rest of us. That's what it is. And the empire feeds off the republic. You can see that happening. This empire is getting bigger and bigger. It's got massive bases in Kosovo, in Central Asia, in places like Kyrgyzstan. It's got all sorts of fleets, nuclear fleets and aircraft carriers and drones and missiles, and it spends more money on the military, on that empire. It spends more money than all the other countries put together spend. So this is what it's about. As that empire gets richer and bigger and more powerful, more involved, it's waging 2, 3, 4 wars or military interventions at any one time. Meanwhile, the republic is getting poorer. We've got bridges are falling apart. We've got infrastructure that's falling apart. We've got social services that are getting shabby. We're becoming like a third world country. We got we just got. I mean, life is just getting very tough for ordinary Americans. And they
think they're told that
it's getting very tough for them because all this money is going to the immigrants and to the people in the ghettos and the like. That's baloney. Those people get almost nothing. The lower you are on the trough, on the feeding line, the less you get.
Yeah, they make.
And once Americans understand that, they can shove that kind of propaganda that Koch and Murdoch and Fox are feeding them. But now they just keep getting this stuff. And if you watch Fox News, you'll notice that it's not, you always often think of a conservative or reactionary as apologizing for our system. We got the best in the world. Oh, everything's so nice. Everything's good. They're not that way. It's all fear. It's all fear. They talk. Now they're back again. Every year they talk about how Christmas is being taken away from them because somebody said Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas, you know. So, I mean, crazy, stupid things. But fear that something's happening.
Dr. Ferendi, it scares the hell out of these old people out here. They all vote Republican, and some of them are old FDR Democrats, but they get frightened about that, and you really hit a raw nerve out here because among our listeners, because the fiscal cliff is now the current fear factor being peddled out here hardcore. Even on national public radio this morning, our local affiliate here out of Lawrence, Kansas, University of Kansas, broadcast a news late saying, and this is how it was, I'm almost quoting it exact, the military has said the political rivalry between the parties in the United States spells a certain catastrophe for the military. That's almost a quote, word for word.
That for the U.S. military?
The fiscal cliff is spelled, and they politely word it as a catastrophe for the military.
Yeah, which means...
Because of political rivalry between the parties. That's a quote. Political rivalries between the parties.
Yeah, suddenly they're against rivalry because their boys lost. And so now... And so now the Democrats can't just go ahead and push a more liberal and more humane and more equitable and a more prosperous agenda. It would be an agenda that would create more jobs, create a bigger tax base. It would be a hell of a lot better. But the Democrats are so feeble in some ways. I mean, they are the abused partner. They're the battered partner in an abusive relationship. That's what it is. And you always see them saying, well, we don't disagree that much. Well, they're always reaching out. You don't hear the Republican. You don't hear the reactionary saying that. You don't hear the people on Fox saying that. They pounce on every disagreement they can find to make every issue, a really serious one. Well, how about if we wind it down, Mike?
Now, listeners, this is Dr. Michael Parenti at Michael Parenti, PARENTI.org, and I interfered with his weekend. He has a guest, and I'm really happy to have what time we had with you, and I want to invite you back, Dr. Parenti.
Okay, well, maybe some other time too, and I wish you progressives who are rallying in Kansas, I wish you luck and hit hard. That's all, and don't worry about compromising. You don't compromise with the truth. Just get the truth out there about who it is who is taking over so much and hurting the ordinary working people of this world, including our own country.
That's right, and thank you. And remember that quote, listeners. It's the empire feeding off the republic, and that's you and me. And thank you, Dr. Parenti, for coming on today.
Okay, thank you. All right, bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Listeners, you are not going to get this kind of programming here in Kansas. I'll tell you that right now. It is vitally important that you support Dr. It's Michael Parenti, PARENTI.org. His books are, he's 23 books. You know, you can look at the webpage with the pictures. Those are book covers. And I didn't get Face of Imperialism, his latest book, on the pictures. But you can just, you know, go to michaelparenti.org and you will not regret even reading the website. I think you really are going to enjoy learning more about Parenti's genius. He really is a genius. I'll be right back with you. I Well, we would have had him on a little bit longer, but he was having a weekend, and we all are having a weekend. But it's never too late, and I want to put on the latest Free Speech Radio news as of last night, because we weren't able to do it when Tom Hayden, on his show for the Wichita Peace Center last night. So here we go with the latest Free Speech Radio news.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 7th, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, climate change talks wrap up in Doha with little progress. We'll speak to a delegate from the Philippines as the country responds to deadly Typhoon Bopha. As fighting in Syria continues to take lives and displace civilians, U.S. officials urge Russia to help end the conflict. And in the UK, labour rights activists fight Starbucks' plan to cut sick days and maternity benefits. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The Supreme Court announced today it will hear the Proposition 8 case, Hollingsworth v. Perry. The court will determine if denying same-sex couples the right to marry is a violation of the 14th Amendment. The High Court will also hear arguments in a case challenging the Defense of Marriage Act. In that case, Windsor v. United States, a New York woman sued because she was forced to pay estate taxes after her partner died, something not required of married heterosexual couples. SCOTUS blog reports that in both cases, the justices have given themselves a way not to rule on the actual issue of same-sex marriage and instead rule on procedural issues. The arguments in these cases will likely be heard in late March, with decisions issued in June. A coalition of Egyptian opposition groups has rejected President Mohamed Morsi's call for dialogue to defuse the country's escalating political crisis. FSRN's Noel King reports from Cairo.
In a statement, the opposition National Salvation Front said the president failed to address the role his supporters played in violent street clashes outside of the presidential palace on Wednesday night. At least five people were killed and hundreds injured when members of Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood confronted members of the opposition who were camped outside of the president's office. The two groups battled for hours using homemade clubs, rocks, and pellet guns. Today, the opposition attempted to keep up the pressure on Morsi. Thousands of demonstrators rallied again outside of the presidential palace as night fell in Cairo. In another part of the city, thousands of Morsi's supporters attended the funeral of two of the president's sympathizers, who were killed in Wednesday's clashes. Some members of the funeral procession vowed they would avenge the deaths. Morsi says he will not back down from plans to push ahead with a December 15th referendum on the country's constitution. His opponents say they're unwilling to negotiate until he agrees to rescind a controversial order in which Morsi granted himself sweeping powers of authority. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
The Manmohan Singh-led central government in India has won parliamentary approval of its controversial decision to open the country's retail sector to foreign investors. The vote today follows months of protests against the plan that allows international retail giants like Walmart to have greater influence in the country. FSRN's Bismila Gilani reports.
The vote in Parliament followed weeks of deadlock, with the opposition demanding a thorough debate on the issue. Earlier, the government's decision to allow international corporations to enter India's retail sector evoked nationwide protests from small traders, hawkers, and street vendors, who see the move as a serious threat to their livelihood. But the opposition saw defeat, first in the lower house, and today the upper house approved the measure. The Singh government says the victory clears the way for many more economic reforms. Opposition leaders accuse the government of identifying with the foreign multinational companies and not with the ordinary Indians. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
The unemployment rate in the U.S. has dropped to 7.7%, bucking wide speculation that the devastation of Hurricane Sandy would hurt the jobs market nationwide. The economy continued to add jobs at about the same rate seen in recent months. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis said the hurricane did not affect the jobless rate, but did cause 1.5 million people to experience a disruption in employment. She cautioned Washington against allowing middle-class tax rates to rise. The unemployment rate is the lowest since 2008. The so-called real unemployment rate continued to fall as well, hitting 14.4% for November. The nearly two-month occupation of the foreclosed home of the Lucero family, dubbed Fort Lucero, continues in East Los Angeles today. The Occupy Our Homes campaign commemorated their one-year anniversary with protests in more than a dozen cities Thursday. In Atlanta, Minneapolis, and elsewhere, occupiers took over bank-owned foreclosed homes and used them to house the homeless, FSRN's Larry Buell reports.
A handful of homeowners and dozens of supporters unfurled banners and held protest signs at Los Angeles City Hall Thursday. The signs read, "Defend your home, and the banks will fail." The homeowners accused the banks of indifference, and they thanked those who have put their bodies on the line to stop foreclosure evictions. On any given night, dozens of occupiers can be found at the so-called Fort Hernandez in Van Nuys and Fort Lucero in East Los Angeles. Salvadori has occupied Fort Lucero for nearly 60 days. He blames the bank for turning a blind eye to struggling homeowners.
They profited off of people and they ripped a lot of people off in the crisis in 2008 when the bubble crashed, the housing bubble. And I think it's horrible. What I want to see is like the banks get more scared because there's more people coming out.
Occupiers say they've lost all trust in government and that leaders are too beholden to the banks. They say they'll keep fighting because, so far, it's working. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. As the death toll in the Philippines from Typhoon Bofa rises above 500 with tens of thousands homeless, the UN climate conference in Doha is drawing to a close. After 2 weeks of talks, wealthy nations have refused to sign up to significant pollution cuts. In his closing speech yesterday, the head of the Philippine delegation, Nadarev Sanyo, called on world leaders to open their eyes to the stark reality. Nadarev Sanyo joins us now on a cell phone in Doha. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your country is currently dealing with a major disaster from the typhoon, and a new analysis from the Global Climate Risk Index said the Philippines led the world in deaths from extreme weather last year. What do you want from world leaders in order for your country to address these deadly storms?
Typhoon Bopha, the storm that recently struck the Philippines, is an example of an extreme event that was not anticipated. It hit an area of the Philippines that was typhoon-free for over half a century. And this is a clear case of the changes that are taking place. Now, what we want to see from world leaders is taking responsibility for this global problem.
In your closing speech, you said that the outcome of the talks should not be about what political masters want, but what 7 billion people want. Can you just give some examples of how these talks have been hijacked and undermined by political maneuvering?
In many areas that we deal with here, the main excuse of our negotiating partners, mainly from developed countries, is that this is the mandate from their political masters. The climate change crisis cannot be solved by political expedience. It cannot be solved by using competitiveness as an excuse. It can only be solved by global cooperation and for developed countries to take responsibility for the obligations that they agreed to in the Climate Change Convention. And that is simply what we are asking for.
How do you view the role of the U.S. negotiators at this meeting, and what sort of discussions have you had with them?
What we have seen in terms of the negotiations with respect to the positions of the U.S. is that they refuse to acknowledge responsibility for the provision of resources, especially in mobilizing financial resources. That is a legal obligation under the convention.
How important was the British government's contribution of $3 billion in climate aid?
We are still trying to sort out all of these reports that developed countries are coming out with. There is a lack of clarity on how these funds are spent, and how these funds are allocated, and whether they are in fact new and additional over and above official development assistance.
Final negotiations are going on today and possibly Saturday. Where's the most serious area where the current agreement falls short, do you think?
Well, the key deliverables here in Doha, at least from the point of view of many developing countries, is first the adoption of the amendments to the Kyoto Protocol that will set the basis for ensuring that the world is on a track towards a trajectory that addresses climate change effectively.
Your position at the conference has been a difficult one because of the disaster that's going on in the Philippines at the moment. How has that affected your negotiating, and can you tell us a little bit about the latest of what you're hearing about the situation in your country?
At least 500 people confirmed killed in the southern Philippines. 400 people more are buried in under the mud and under debris. Also, 250,000 are still in evacuation centers, and they need relief assistance, relief goods, medicine, clothes, and food. That is the situation right now. In terms of how it has affected our delegation, this has been very difficult for us, considering also that several members of our delegation hail from the area that was hit by the typhoon. Well, in a way, it has also increased our resolve to fight for an ambitious, successful outcome here in Doha.
Nader Ehsanyo, head of the Philippines delegation at the Doha Climate Conference, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Youth activists at the climate conference in Doha occupied the hallways of the venue today to call on countries to reject the text. They say it's clear that any agreement reached will be an empty shell and an insult to their futures. Marco Cadena is a London-based organiser with the climate network Push Europe. He was at the protest this morning and he joins us now from Doha. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Hi there.
You blame the rich industrialised countries for the failure here, and they've refused to sign up to significant pollution cuts, and you say the agreement could push developing countries to accept an unacceptable deal. What are your biggest concerns?
The biggest concern here is that if developing countries are forced into a deal, that could look a deal that is unacceptable. That will lock them in, lock the whole world in for about 10 years of inaction, and there will be no finance for the poorest countries to adopt or even do anything about climate change or climate mitigation. And there will be no significant emissions cuts from developed countries. So, whereas science tells us that in the next 10 years we have to make significant emissions cuts in developed countries in order to keep the temperature rise within 2 degrees centigrade on a global average. So this is really a crunch time.
Your organisation is working on its own statement. What concrete action will it call for?
Arbit is about pressuring the EU and making sure that the EU negotiators, especially the head of the delegation, Connie Hedegaard, knows that we are watching, and if they force developing countries into this kind of locking in deal, that will get them a lot of trouble back home, because we are already mobilizing, and we will make sure that 2013 is going to be one of the biggest climate mobilizing year that's ever been in Europe, especially because the COP is coming, the Conference of the Parties, the climate talks are coming back to Europe, to Poland next year.
From the final hours of the Doha Climate Conference, Marco Cadena, London-based organizer with Push Europe, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much.
A bill to repeal Cold War-era trade restrictions with Russia and Moldova is headed to President Obama's desk after passing the US Senate on Thursday. But Russian officials are condemning provisions aimed at punishing Russian citizens accused of human rights abuses. The move comes as US lawmakers and diplomats examine Russia's role supporting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's embattled regime, and now possibly negotiating an end to the conflict. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The Senate overwhelmingly approved a measure to establish permanent normalized trade relations with Russia and Moldova this week. a move spurred by the country's entries into the World Trade Organization. But senators attached another measure to the bill that requires the federal government to freeze the assets and deny visas to any Russian citizen accused of human rights abuses. That measure's author, Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin, hopes it will be expanded in the future to cover anyone of any nationality.
Those who are gross violators of human rights, they're not going to be able to travel to the United States or use our banking system. The legislation sets a precedent for international conduct that we expect will be honored globally.
Named for Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian lawyer who was beaten to death in prison in 2009, the measure drew criticism and threats of retaliation from the Russian Foreign Ministry. Minutes after Thursday's Senate vote, the ministry posted on Twitter, quote, "This biased approach is nothing but a vindictive desire to counter Russia in world affairs." And, quote, "Apparently Washington has forgotten what year it is and still thinks that the Cold War is going on." The Russian government accused the U.S. of hypocrisy when it comes to human rights and said the bill's passage would, quote, "quite negatively affect the prospects of bilateral cooperation." Though the Magnitsky bill was inspired by a single case of retaliation, many international groups broadly criticized Russia's human rights record this year as the government moved to suppress some protests and other forms of expression, and violence against journalists, LGBT people, and political dissidents continued. The same day as the Senate vote, diplomats from the U.S. and Russia met in Dublin to talk about another area of human rights concern, the ongoing conflict in Syria, where tens of thousands have been killed. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told reporters Thursday evening that she, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, and UN envoy on Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, agreed that the Syrian crisis should be settled through ongoing mediation with Russia and Syria, which will begin in the next few days.
We have been trying hard to work with Russia to stop the bloodshed in Syria and start a political transition toward a post-Assad Syrian future. We've made it very clear what our position is with respect to chemical weapons, and I think we will discuss that and many other aspects of what needs to be done in order to end the violence and begin that transition that I referred to.
Other U.S. officials had harsher words for the Russian government this week, especially regarding the country's support of the Assad regime. Though he voted for opening up more trade with Russia on Thursday, Delaware Democrat Chris Coons said the Kremlin bears some responsibility for the violence in Syria by vetoing UN Security Council resolutions against Assad and economically backing him.
We can effectively call on the Russians to be responsible partners, to be accountable for having gotten us in some way to this point.
In a press conference filled with echoes of the lead-up to the invasion in Iraq, Coons and his colleagues repeatedly said that Assad is preparing to use chemical weapons against his own people. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said this week that there are no confirmed reports of this, but Arizona Republican John McCain is not convinced.
We have now reached a point where there are weapons of mass destruction that may be used. It's now up to the Russians to do everything possible and maximize their influence over Bashar Assad to make sure that he does not use these weapons.
McCain called on President Obama to make his recent threats to Assad credible by showing a willingness to use military force. But other lawmakers, including outgoing Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich, are less eager to get involved. Kucinich released a statement saying the U.S. should not become, quote, embroiled in another conflict we can't afford. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Republican lawmakers in Michigan's House and Senate rushed through controversial right-to-work legislation, prompting strong protests from workers, unions, and Democrats.
Right to work has got to go, hey, hey, ho, ho! Right to work has got to go, hey, hey, ho, ho!
Supporters say the Workplace Fairness and Equity Act will boost the economy. But opponents say the legislation, which would prohibit union fees as a condition of employment, is driven by corporations who want to boost profits and disempower workers. Before the vote Thursday, Senator Burt Johnson condemned Republicans' move in an hour-long speech.
After Lord knows how many backroom meetings with Republican leaders and their CEO bosses, after no committee hearings, after no notice to the public, after shutting them out, and in the frenzied rush of the lame duck session, Republican legislators have put forth a right-to-work bill that they intend to jam through this legislative body before the end of the year. Maybe it wasn't clear to the Michigan GOP that in the wake of their corporate raider candidate Mitt Romney getting his clock cleaned by my president, by your president, Barack Hussein Obama, in November, Michiganders do not support attempts by CEOs to undermine workers' rights.
Police made a number of arrests Thursday. More protests are expected next Tuesday when Republican supporters aim to finalize the legislation. Michigan's governor supports the bill, which could be signed as early as next week. Coffee chain Starbucks announced that it might pay about $16 million a year in corporate taxes after the latest controversy over how little tax it has paid since opening for business in the UK in 1998. But it has sparked other concerns by slashing workers' benefits. Starbucks plans to cut paid lunch breaks, sick days, and maternity benefits, but labor groups and workers have vowed to fight back. From Southampton in the UK, Gloria Kamkar has more.
The cuts would affect thousands of workers at hundreds of stores across the UK. The major campaigning trade union in the UK, GMB, is protesting these changes on behalf of its members who are the Starbucks workers. GMB's Southern Regional Organiser, Adrian Baker, comments on how badly Starbucks is handling the tax issue.
Starbucks, in the last few months, has become a byword for evading tax, tax evasion. This is an employer of 8,500 people across the United Kingdom. At the same time, looking at cutting the pay breaks of the staff, they're looking at impacting maternity rights, they're looking at changes to other aspects of terms and conditions of employment.
Earlier this week, Starbucks asked employees to sign a document outlining the cuts, according to The Guardian. But the company doesn't recognize the union, so employees had no bargaining options. Baker says that the company provided only two options, sign the new job terms or leave.
I mean, there are two words there that you use. One's discussed, one's informed. If you turn around to the staff and you inform them, you can proclaim to have had a discussion. Discussion is a two-way action, and it doesn't seem from what we've got back from Starbucks that they're interested in what would be considered a discussion. I mean, there are GMB members that have, they've obviously chosen to join a union because of the manner in which they've been treated at work. They seek dignity and respect. They'd like good terms and conditions of employment. And yet Starbucks don't wish to engage with the union to discuss this further, which is a shame.
Outside a Starbucks in Southampton, customers leave the store with hot lattes and holiday drinks. One barista, who preferred to remain anonymous to avoid retaliation, said workers already have a hard time making ends meet.
Because of all this, we are really upset. The new contract and the new terms and conditions are really terrible for us. It looks like the company is trying to pay the tax, and they're going to take it from our pockets, which are really very small. Unfortunately, I'm going to suffer more than anyone else because of all these new terms and conditions. Company is justifying it, but basically they're saying it because they're going to pay more taxes. They're going to save some money. Actually, they're going to save money by taking money from us. It's me who's going to suffer. Who else? It's a very sad state.
The GMB said it's not going to give up until this issue has been resolved.
There are going to be a considerable number of demonstrations across the country this weekend. I would be very surprised if there's a Starbucks up and down the United Kingdom that doesn't have some form of demonstration at some point in time.
The activist group UK Uncut is also participating in actions at Starbucks locations on Saturday. It's targeting the corporation for tax dodging and the impact of government spending cuts on women. Gloria Khamkar, FSRN, Southampton, United Kingdom.
In Argentina, a new law to break up media monopolies was to come into force today. But the Clarín Group, the largest media owner in Argentina, has won a last-minute reprieve. The law was passed in 2009, but Clarín won a number of judicial injunctions that delayed its implementation. On Thursday evening, the Argentine Federal Civil and Commercial Court stated that Clarín does not have to sell its radio and television broadcast licenses until the courts rule on the law's constitutionality. non-profit and local radio and television stations who had hoped to benefit from the law now have to wait. From Buenos Aires, Eilish O'Neill has more.
Desde la Caterva, información en movimiento.
The community radio station La Caterva has been broadcasting for 2 years in the poor Buenos Aires neighborhood of Barracas, also home to the city's largest shanty town. According to Santiago Asati, one of the station's hosts, Radio La Caterva offers programming that can't be found elsewhere, including discussions of gender issues, poverty, human rights, and alternatives to capitalism.
And also, we are promoting and working with people from the Bolivian community here in Argentina to produce a radio program that is bilingual in Quechua and in Spanish. So our compañeras, we said, makes the effort to talk in Quechua and to translate that to Spanish.
Radio La Caterva is one arm of the People's Movement for Dignity, which also includes the Dignity Cafe, which is run as a cooperative. The radio station broadcasts from a preschool, and like many community radio stations throughout Latin America, doesn't have a government-issued broadcast license. But Asadi says it has another form of legitimacy. It belongs to the people.
We think that our right is by being communitary, and alternative and popular.
Argentina's new media law theoretically addresses situations like that of La Caterva. It grants 33% of broadcast licenses to non-profit organizations. Radio stations with a history of broadcasting on a given frequency will be granted a license as long as they jump through several administrative hoops. Lawyer Dolores Larraiche, a specialist in the public's right to information, says it was about time for a new media law.
The previous version was a law that was dictated by a military president, and that had been modified several times. It wasn't a law that dealt with the whole issue, and it was also very out of date in terms of modern technology.
In fact, the Argentine Forum for Community Radio has been working for a new media law for the past 2 decades, says spokesperson Gustavo Videla.
We fought for this. We worked for this. For this reason, we helped edit the law. Broadly speaking, we're extremely pleased with the passage of the law, which took down a law from the dictatorship and established a democratic law.
The new media law not only seeks to benefit local and non-profit radio and television stations, but also aims to break up the alleged monopoly of the Clarín Group, which owns not only Argentina's largest newspaper, but also numerous television and radio licenses. Under the new law, the Clarín Group will have to auction off many of those licenses. Other licenses will be given to whoever is already broadcasting on a given frequency. According to Santiago Asati of Radio La Caterva, an unidentified commercial radio station has been trying to claim a broadcast history by interfering with La Caterva's signal. Asati says the government should step in and protect La Caterva's right to broadcast, but he's concerned that it's more interested in breaking up the monopoly of the anti-government Clarín Group than in benefiting community radio stations.
We agree to make Clarín to disinvest, to recover licenses in order to give to the community media, not to give them to the other private monopolies that the state are creating. The people, the ones who are down, the ones who does not compete in this, we have not so much capital. We are like watching outside. Our struggle, our fight, our rights should be defended.
Lawyer Dolores Larraiche calls the court's ruling timely because it maintains the status quo until the media law's constitutionality can be decided. But the Argentine Forum for Community Radio has issued a statement that it is indignant with a ruling that gives the Clarín Group more time to flout the law. The statement adds that sooner or later, Clarín will have to comply. In order to speed up a legal process that has already lasted 3 years, the head of President Cristina Kirchner's cabinet has asked the Supreme Court to decide the question of the media law's constitutionality without waiting for appeals from lower courts. Eilish O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
And that's the program for today and for the week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.
Would you like your group announcement, or maybe you're holding a demonstration and would like it read on Radio Free Kansas? There's no charge for this service, and it gets out to a large audience of listeners in Kansas who can think for themselves. You and your friends don't have a corporate logo or brand name, but maybe want to manufacture dissent and democracy instead of conformity. Radio Free Kansas is the place to have your news announced to a large community in the reddest of all states, Kansas, or as we've been calling it lately, Brownbackistan. The disappointing news is you might not get your news on Radio Free Kansas. Sorry. If you were a cheerleader for the last two bankrupting wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, go elsewhere. Or how about a paranoid gun rubber trying to get your buds to go camping, sitting along some Kansas creek by a campfire, planning some racist New World Order, won't get the next gun show announced on Radio Free Kansas either. How about 24% of the conservative voters who go to church regularly and believe President Obama is the Antichrist or a space alien without a birth certificate? Well, you can try. You believe in angels, demons, and magical miracles, don't you? Send it in, you never know, or maybe you believe you do? If you think Kansans, smart Kansans, might be interested in coming to your event, go ahead and send it in. Feel free. It's free. Email to bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. That's bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. Please provide some contact information, such as an email address or a phone number. And thank you for listening to Radio Free Kansas.